hemispheres hadn't formally met. And Columbus's arrival on a Caribbean island in 1492 led to a frenzied exchange of crops. Potatoes, tomatoes, and corn from Central and South America became staples in Europe and Asia. Crops from the Old World, like bananas, coffee, sugar, and citrus, found fertile growing conditions in the New World. So much so that within a few hundred years, the Americas became top producers of them all. Historians call that period the Columbian Exchange and mark it the official bridge to modern times, when two worlds fused into one. Technically, Columbus never set foot in North America, nor did he do any agricultural swapping himself. And many of the people living there, the Native Americans that he believed were Indians, benefited little from the agricultural exchange. There were relatively few people on so much land, around 50 million on 6 billion acres. While Europeans were busy introducing to the New World foods that they thought would improve the native people's lives, they were also importing new diseases that ended them, such as smallpox, measles, cholera, and influenza. Smallpox alone is thought to have diminished Native American populations with horrific devastation rarely seen in history. When English colonists landed, they found a heavily wooded continent, overgrown and underused, prime for them to create a portrait of their former lives. They brought carrots, and not long after, barley, wheat, and peaches. By the 1730s, the process of building a new colony meant building a sustainable system for growing food. James Oglethorpe, the British general keen to develop a colony called Georgia, split his time between governing and innovating food. He experimented with how weather affected crops, believing Georgia's winters were too cold for cotton. They could, however, support silk, hemp, and flax. The peach that made Georgia famous didn't arrive for another 100 years. George Washington, too, realized he was best at waging revolt when he took breaks to hoe the soil. Before he was president, the general studied subtropical agriculture, pleading frequently to London for seeds. Tobacco did well under his watch, but there was more money in wheat. To Mrs. Washington's horror, he spent early mornings investigating the optimal fertilizer, mixing oddities like animal manure, mud, and black mold that grew on a hillside near his house. Count among Washington's gifts to his future nation his revelation that cows, rather than horses or sheep, provide the most potent dung. Thomas Jefferson, President Number 3, spent America's early days in France. When he returned, he had the foresight to know that for a new nation to survive, it needed more food. The greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its culture, Jefferson wrote in 1800. He particularly liked grain, which was second in value only to oil, but he knew self-sufficiency required diversity. If the newly created foreign consuls were good for anything, they could send seeds, and consuls in France, England, Italy, and the Netherlands did. Thomas Jefferson loved fruits of the earth as much as he loved liberty, which is why, for all his efforts, he sits beside Willie Nelson, crooner of the Heartland, in the National Agricultural Hall of Fame. In America's infancy, food wasn't a sector. It was almost the whole economy. Farmers accounted for 90% of the United States labor force in 1790. 50 years later, they were 60%, and a generation after that, they were just over half. Today, they're less than 2%. Accounting for America's swelling population during that time, from 4 million to 31 million, there were more individual farmers in the late 19th century than ever before, or again, in American history. Because of this, the government focused an extraordinary amount of attention and money on agrarian matters. In the years following Abraham Lincoln's presidency, courses on horticulture, the era's equivalent to modern biotechnology, were taught in nearly every university. Federal officials gave land to states to analyze crops, their diseases, and how to grow them at large scale. Compared to today's political campaigns that rise and fall on money, media, and messaging, the first campaigns were a calculation of food. The earliest pork from Washington wasn't pork. It was seeds for corn, wheat, and barley in small envelopes that congressmen would stuff in their pockets and, when home in their districts, hand out with a wink. In 1881, William G. LeDuc, the agriculture commissioner, wrote to his boss, Rutherford B. Hayes, that the seed distribution program was a resounding success. "It is now generally conceded that the distribution of seeds from this department is doing incalculable good." It was one way Washington worked directly for the people, and for a congressman with deep pockets, reason enough to vote for him again. When Fairchild arrived in December of 1893, Naples greeted him with an assault on the senses. Loud voices pierced the streets. Horses trotted along, their ankles crusted in dung. To be a foreigner was distressing. When his steamship, the Fulda, docked, a group of burly men, sweaty, with shimmering muscles, came to unload the baggage, fighting one another over every item, and, with grand gestures, demanding tips for their service. The high-pitched screaming voices, the continual gesticulations, and the insistent demands for money made it a nightmare to me, Fairchild recalled. Outside the port, Naples was filled with an air of laziness that no breeze could arouse. People walked during the day, sidestepping piles of uncollected garbage, to sit on the grand seawall that protected the city from the dull waves of the Mediterranean. A traveling reporter for the Chicago Sunday Tribune found the city lethargic, lacking drive and passion, as if hung over from the grand centuries of artistic titans and extraordinary scholars of theology. Sitting on the seawall in Naples and dangling one's legs is not a very remunerative employment, and yet crowds of able-bodied men spend day after day in this easy occupation and in others that are like it, he reported to readers back home, many of whom had taken back-breaking roles in America's Industrial Revolution. Italy would soon experience its own rapid economic growth as a result of advances in steelmaking and cotton milling, but that spurt hadn't arrived, and certainly not in Naples. There were hordes of lazzaroni, people who spent their days cooking atop stoves in the street, putting in enough work each week to afford only the macaroni they ate, the rest of the time filled with smoke, gossip, and catcalls. Fairchild had gone to Naples without a place to live. Arranging a room in advance would have required a correspondent, and corresponding would have required a basic knowledge of Italian. An Italian painter on board the Fulda, returning from America, where he'd exhibited paintings at the Chicago World's Fair, sensed Fairchild's shock, took pity, and invited Fairchild to join him in a horse-drawn carrozza that clopped through the narrow streets, depositing him at the apartment of the artist's brother, who conveniently needed a boarder. The room had a view of Mount Vesuvius near a new funicular that carried a steam-powered compartment up a hill. There was a fascination in the young man, the type one finds when landing in a foreign place, and he had to remind himself not to gawk at foreign peculiarities, the writing on signs, the sounds of an unfamiliar language, the people, how they dressed and looked, and how they seemed not to notice him. Fairchild filled his notebooks with fits and starts, giving the impression that he stopped every few feet to jot observations. The city was full of pestiferous ragamuffins. His meals of hard bread were disappointing, and his silverware only sketchily washed. These small snubs were both memorable and insignificant. What truly delighted him was that, all around, he could hear nothing but Italian. He spent the first few nights wandering the streets, first by himself and then with his landlord's son. They attempted to communicate in Italian until Fairchild's piecemeal vocabulary would sputter, and then they would slip into a theater for an inexpensive play, the kind where people stood and heckled the melodramatic actors. One play that particularly struck Fairchild had 13 characters who were all killed, scene by scene, in increasingly gruesome ways, until only two were left, a pair of lovers, who declared their devotion in a horrific double suicide. The first day Fairchild reported for work, people were expecting someone older The Smithsonian's zoological station was a place where men of science worked in secluded silence, unraveling the great mysteries of biological life. Fairchild, however, had come without a research goal. He had already achieved his principal objective, which was to travel somewhere outside the bounds of his country. All he had when he arrived in Italy was the eagerness of a 24-year-old ready to stand over a microscope and help wherever needed. When his advisor, Paul Mayer, a marine biologist, asked about his interests, Fairchild told him, "As a boy, I watched termites build nests, but at the department we studied crop diseases." Mayer suggested that Fairchild study the cells of algae that grew in the Bay of Naples. Only recently had cells piqued the interest of scientists, particularly how cells divide, seemingly endlessly, suggesting they could perpetuate infinite life. Every morning, the station's head boatman dredged the bay and filled balloons with water that glowed green in the sunlight. Fairchild spent each afternoon and evening on the highest setting of his microscope, watching the process known as karyokinesis as the cells split. Meanwhile, outside the lab were unlimited opportunities for distraction. He spent his evenings watching people in the city's Piazza del Plebiscito, or wandering to the coast for a view across the water to the island of Capri. In Naples, where pizza was invented, Fairchild tasted his first cheesy flatbread, a punishing food for first-timers whose mouths could be scorched with hot, lava-like cheese. He was enchanted by the various shapes of macaroni, and pastries were works of history. Naples' mixed heritage over several centuries from the French, Spanish, and Austrians resulted in flaky, sweet pastries, yeast cakes drowned in rum, and deep-fried dough balls known as zeppole, each one an ancestor of the modern donut. Despite the contagion of indolence, there were few places more picturesque than Naples for one's first taste of foreign charm. 4,000 years of continuous history left deep footprints in art and culture. The bronze statues, the marble sculptures, the paintings that hadn't made it to New York City, let alone Manhattan, Kansas. In an old Bourbon palace known as the Capodimonte, the masterpieces of artists Fairchild had only read about, Michelangelo, Raphael, Botticelli, were on display in their original and full-color glory. Art was art, but no 24-year-old could ignore that often the people in the paintings weren't wearing any clothes. There was seaweed on his desk, rotting and stinking, the morning someone knocked on Fairchild's door. The person walked in with two thick pieces of paper, calling cards, each engraved with a name. Barbara Lathrop, Chicago, Illinois, and Raphael Pompelli, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Fairchild first thought the men had left their cards, terrifying in itself. But there they were, climbing the stairs, at a moment when his room smelled of ocean bacteria and his shirt was stained green with chlorophyll. He hadn't remembered Lathrop's behavior, blustery, unpredictable, and apathetic of his breach in etiquette at arriving unannounced. Lathrop answered only to Lathrop, and after his detour in Morocco, he'd asked Pompelli, the professor from the boat, to help him find that young man who wanted to travel. "The professor and I thought we'd come to see how you were getting along," Lathrop said as he mounted the last step and invited himself into the room. With his military posture and gray mustache, Lathrop impressed Fairchild anew. Next to Lathrop, Pompelli somehow looked more official, standing erect with piercing eyes, a jacket, a vest, a cane. Fairchild didn't speak. He had neither time nor anything to say, just the instinct that he had done something wrong, or was about to. "I've been below here many times, but never knew there was anything like this in the upper story," Lathrop said, answering a question no one had asked. He sat, then took out his cigarette holder and lit a cigarette before asking, "One is allowed to smoke here?" Lathrop asked him what he was working on. "Karyokinesis," Fairchild said, pleased that his first word could be a large one. "The what?" Lathrop cut in sharply. "Karyokinesis, the way that a cell divides. I'm trying to observe the nuclei. I've been using the cells of green seaweed from—
You told me on the boat that you wanted to go to Java, Lathrop interrupted. Have you given up that idea?
For now, the trip is beyond my means.
Well, I've decided to give you $1,000 with which to go to Java,
Lathrop said before inhaling deeply.
I want you to understand that I look upon this $1,000 as an investment, nothing more. I have had you looked up, and you seem to be all right. You must understand that this is no personal matter. I want that clearly understood. It is merely my idea of making an investment in science.
Fairchild said nothing. Lathrop inhaled again, sat for another moment, and then rose. Before he slipped through the doorway, he turned around again.
Oh, and I'd like to have you lunch with me at the Tivoli Hotel at 1 o'clock.
Less than 3 minutes had passed, and the men were descending the steps. Fairchild's head was in a whirl. He tried to make sense of what had happened. He marveled first at the money, and then at the reality that he might actually see Java, and then back to the money. $1,000, the modern equivalent of $20,000, was more than he'd ever seen, twice the era's average salary for a full year. One Christmas, his aunt and uncle had given him $50, which to any young man would have felt like a fortune. Lunch passed quickly, for much of it Lathrop recalling stories about his travels and triumphs, amusing himself more than anyone else, pausing characteristically for breaks from chewing to squint his eyes and nod slowly as though dusting off a distant memory. Fairchild understood his role was to listen, and for that Lathrop enjoyed his company. After lunch, Lathrop suggested they see Carmen, a French opera about an undisciplined soldier lured away from his wife by a gypsy. The performance started at 9 and lasted 5 hours, during which Fairchild was less entertained by the actors than by Lathrop's knowing sighs at turns in the plot. It was 3 in the morning when they arrived at Fairchild's house. In the carroza, Fairchild waited for Lathrop to finish his final story about the last time he had visited Naples. Lathrop seemed a peculiar man, talking in a flow of running consciousness, unconcerned about whether he retained his listener's attention. Fairchild thanked Lathrop for the evening, then climbed down to the street.
"Well, don't you think you'd better have my address?" Lathrop called after him.
For the money. In Fairchild's attempt to remain polite, to come across as deferential and courteous, the money had slipped his mind. He took out his red notebook and, as Lathrop dictated, wrote the older man's address. Barber Lathrop, Esquire, Bank of Scotland, 19 Bishopsgate, Street Within, London, E.C. Although it had been longer, the second meeting of the two men confused Fairchild more than the first. It still wasn't clear whether Lathrop actually liked David Fairchild, or simply saw in him an opportunity to cure his glamorous boredom. And there was the matter of the money, which Lathrop emphasized was neither a gift nor a favor, but an investment that he expected to pay off. How, he didn't say, because he didn't know. But as a millionaire, he could afford to find out later. The transaction would soon turn out to be wise, both for the men and for their country. But it would be some time before either man knew. As Fairchild turned toward the door to the house, Lathrop yelled, "Avanti!" And the coachman cracked his whip and whisked the carriage away. Chapter 3. East of Suez. The letters arrived with foreign postmarks. Cape Town, Singapore, Hong Kong, Oahu. In each one, Lathrop was baffled by how long it was taking his young investment to get to Java. Over a year had passed since the meeting on the boat, and 11 months since Lathrop's surprise visit in Naples to discuss the particulars of the deal. To Lathrop, a man restless enough to circle the globe every year, Fairchild's foot-dragging was maddening at best, and at worst, just rude. Fairchild had received Lathrop's letters, but despite the unsubtle push to get moving, he spent a year convincing himself that he wasn't ready for Java.
An opportunity as big as what Lathrop offered shouldn't be squandered by insufficient preparation. "How foolish I would be to go to Java without better training," Fairchild wrote. The boyhood dream of seeing the Malay Islands at any cost had been replaced by the sensible reality that he had little to offer South Asia. Until he did, he'd keep the offer and the money on ice. Fairchild was puzzled by Lathrop's demeanor. There was the older man's generosity, but Lathrop made it clear that his niceties were not nice. He called the money a business transaction, but didn't specify what he expected from his investment. Lathrop seemed more personally interested in Fairchild, as if taking on a mentee or a son, or something different entirely. Their age difference was curious, just 22 years. Shorter, and they might be peers. Longer, perhaps father-son. It surprised Fairchild, as it would most people, to receive such sudden and aggressive attention from an older man. He wrote back to Lathrop, telling him of his new work in Naples, and of the grand scientists he was meeting and valuable work they were doing, with each letter hoping to convince Lathrop that his grant was paying off even before a dime was exchanged. But Fairchild hesitated before sliding each note in the postbox, wary that the contents would aggravate Lathrop to the point that he'd revoke the offer altogether. Fairchild's confidence grew after his heart-stopping trip to Corsica in pursuit of citron. While he was in Naples, a request had come from W.A. Taylor, assistant pomologist for the Department of Agriculture, who, with the endorsement of the Secretary of Agriculture, asked Fairchild to visit Corsica to acquire citron cuttings. The fruit itself was larger and more potent than most lemons, particularly because it existed first. Citrons were one of four major original citrus fruits, along with pomelos, mandarins, and pepitas. The four mixed their genes together to make the modern orange, lemon, and grapefruit. Each one eventually reproduced in the trillions. Future archaeologists would discover citrus to be among the most popular human foods, the rare mix of sweet, tart, and sumptuous, the centerpiece of American fruit salads, breakfast juice, and the all-American lemonade stand, all giving little credit to the fruit's hardy Asian ancestors. Americans in the 1890s were familiar with citron. The country grew a little and imported 2 million pounds each year from abroad. The fruit had arrived not with explorers like Fairchild, but with colonialism, traveling slowly over millennia from its birthplace in South Asia to Italy and Spain, and then brought by Spanish colonists who planted the first citron groves in California. But by 1894, farmers in California had such antiquated fruit that they asked the federal government for better seeds. Taylor could think of only one man in Europe amenable to this kind of freelance work. The trip was a success, even considering Fairchild's brief arrest. After the gendarme let him go, and after Fairchild escaped down the mountain on his mule, and after he acquired the citron cuttings and stuck them into potatoes, he managed to leave Corsica without any further incident. The cuttings arrived in Washington several weeks later, and several months after that, word returned to him that the cuttings had proved of real value to American citrus growers. The saplings would bolster California's citrus market for 20 years, from 20,000 trees to more than a million. The fact that California's citron market later fell from dominance was bittersweet, for the fruit was replaced not by an aggressive fruit competitor, but by a fellow citrus, an orange from Brazil, with a strange cavity on its underside that resembled a belly button. Fairchild, meanwhile, was gaining an odd practicality for a man of 25. Corsica had boosted his ego, but the run-in with the policeman had also awakened him to the dangers of plant espionage. Besides, in the laboratories of Germany were fascinating questions to research, and top scientists to shadow. One, Ted Nichols, was studying the pressure of light waves, supplying knowledge that would be crucial to the later invention of the radio. A man named Rentgen used electromagnetic radiation to produce a fuzzy photo of a key and purse, an early technology that the world would come to know as X-ray photography.
Of sublime interest to Fairchild was the one-eyed mycologist, Oscar Breffeld, whose servant one day arrived holding a heaping platter of horse excrement with the pride of a person carrying a cake. For the next 3 weeks, Breffeld stood guard over the pile, his only good eye pressed to a microscope to inspect layer after layer of mold overtaking the dung. Fairchild needed breaks to calm his stomach, but he admitted that microscopic mold had an absorbing beauty. "Incredible as it may seem," he wrote, "after my first feeling of revulsion had passed, I spent 3 of the most entertaining and instructive weeks of my life studying the fascinating molds, which appeared one by one." Fairchild bided his time at night writing letters, first to his friends in Washington, and then, on a whim, an unsolicited missive to the Botanical Garden of Java. He wanted to inquire, sheepishly, if anyone needed help from an American fungus scientist in training. When an envelope arrived several months later, the biggest surprise was that someone had bothered to write back at all. Correspondence soon blossomed between Fairchild and the garden's director, Melchior Trube, a Dutchman who had built Java's botanical garden into one of the most respected in the world. It's possible that, at 26, Fairchild might never have gone to the Malay Islands. Not because of self-doubt or laziness, but for the relentless force of procrastination. In front of him were grand scientists with ambitious goals. Java could be a spectacular experience, but also a derailing distraction. The promise of $1,000 answered the question of how, but even $1,000,000 couldn't unveil why. Imagining an exasperated Lathrop added urgency, yet the two had met once, twice counting the cursory encounter on the boat, and despite Fairchild's urge to appease his impatient supporter, he wasn't about to alter his life's course to quell Lathrop's anxiety. But in one letter, Fairchild had let slip to Trube that a rich man had promised a mound of silver for Fairchild to make the trip to the East Indies. In the early days of 1896, Trube responded to say that he was soon coming to Europe, and that when he returned to Java, he wanted Fairchild to join him. The Suez Canal was the great engineering marvel connecting the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. It was also the official maritime divider between West and East, and as such, there were strict codes aboard the Dutch steamer regarding what women could wear on either side of the world. The first morning east of the canal, Fairchild unknowingly wandered onto the deck and caught sight of barefoot women splayed under the sun in sarongs. Men weren't supposed to be on deck so early, he thought, but he was wrong. The women had changed to their native and more revealing Javanese garb as soon as the captain allowed. When he learned this, he returned with his camera. Crossing Suez was a novel experience for anyone in the latter part of the 19th century, chiefly because the canal had only existed since 1869. The 100-mile route through the narrowest part of Egypt was perfectly level, requiring no locks, and when the first ships passed through, the 26-foot-deep canal cut the voyage, formerly around the Cape of Good Hope, by 4,000 miles. To mark its global centrality, the French sculptor Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi asked the Egyptian government to let him build a 90-foot statue of an Arab peasant woman wearing robes and holding a torch above her head to welcome Eastern travelers to the Mediterranean. When Egypt declined on account of the project's high cost, he took the idea to France, which financed the sculpture. Once the Muslim woman was refashioned into a Roman goddess, France gifted the statue to the United States, where the woman became a symbol of liberty for immigrants entering New York Harbor. Over the next week, Fairchild reveled in his slow entrance to the tropics. The weather became warmer, the water bluer, and it teemed with birds and fish, including, occasionally, sharks. Then one day, from the ship's railing, Fairchild watched the islands of the Malay archipelago approach. "You approach Java with the feeling of how beautiful and lovable everything seems," he wrote.
He was taken first by the green richness. In an essay Fairchild wrote about his early impression of the tropics, he would five times use the word verdure. From his first night in Java, Fairchild was enchanted. Palms and bamboos covered every square inch of Batavia, the city on the west end of Java that would later be known as Jakarta. At night, loud buzzing insects filled the air with a soundtrack of idyllic leisureliness no one in Washington, D.C. had ever heard. From the patio of the Tony Hotel Bellevue, he could sit under tremendous banyan trees watching people shoulder bamboo sticks with buckets at both ends. No shoes or pavement meant every step was placed in silence. The barefoot people ate rice and fish from wooden bowls without the clang of china. Even the soft and rhythmic language had the melody of a quiet song. For a first-time visitor to the tropics, the natural wonders were like a dream world. Trees carried their roots above the soil, appearing to walk across the ground. Fairchild saw a tiger orchid with a thousand orange blooms, each so perfect and vibrant as though prepared for his arrival. His first experience breaking the purple skin of a mangosteen was maddening, but far better than his first whiff of a durian, the fruit whose sweetness was belied by its putrid smell, which would linger on the lips for hours. He walked through a jungle of rattan palms that attached themselves to his clothes, and he marveled at the quick growth of bamboo, up to a foot a day. The Dutch influence also saw that food was never in short supply for foreigners. At the Hotel Bellevue, meals were the highlight of anyone's day, particularly Fairchild's, who wanted with every bite to taste the simmering stew of the tropics. At lunch, he would pile his plate high with rice, followed by bits of sardines, eggs, and perhaps a banana dripping with hot oil. Down the buffet would be tiny ears of corn and roasted coconut. India's mark on the region meant that the chutneys and curries were, to Fairchild, as hot as liquid fire. A deep burning of the chest came next, but the pain was a tolerable cost. The final course wasn't a food but a nap, keeping with the tropical custom delivered by the Spanish, rendering the hotel silent between 2 and 4 o'clock. Fairchild had never had a servant, but as a white man and a scientist living the colonial life, he was granted one, and his name was Mario. Fairchild had long been averse to slavery, and he also bristled at race-based servitude. Still, despite the barrier of language, the two chatted about girls in the area and the insufferable humidity. Fairchild told Mario about the marvels of the 1893 World's Fair, where there had been two replicas of the Liberty Bell, one made of rolled oats and the other of oranges. In Java, the work that Fairchild decided was finally worth the lengthy trip was to study how termites built colonies. Termites struck Fairchild as ironic, blind and savage warriors that worked as elegant architects of the forest. But the question that had never been answered, at least as far as Fairchild knew, was how a colony functioned, an intricacy no other species copied. The termites would be born in an underground colony, grow wings, and then go from the dark burrows into the open air of the world. In broad daylight, they coupled, two by two, and then, reveling in domestic bliss, would snap off their wings and burrow into the ground to start a new colony. Did they build the fungus gardens in their colonies, or simply eat mushrooms that were already there? The termites weren't eager to reveal their secrets, especially not when exposed to paralyzing light. So finding out required killing thousands of them and opening their stomachs. One afternoon, Fairchild broke open a colony. The mud was dried solid. A hammer finally cracked it in half. Inside were no worker termites, just a king and a queen termite, their plump bodies motionless, as if flustered to be disturbed. The queen, the larger of the two, was as big as Fairchild's thumb, and after he inspected her, he delayed dissecting her pudgy trunk to count the speed at which she excreted eggs. 1 per second, it turned out, an astounding 85,000 in a day. Fairchild figured she'd give life to more than 30 million offspring,
a calculation he completed twice to be sure. The work was solitary and more personally fulfilling than useful, but Fairchild believed he was discovering something new, and he imagined that studying termites could occupy him for decades. It took 2 hours to get from Buitenzorg to the port in Tanjung Priok on Java's north coast. On November 26, 1896, Fairchild would need every minute. The series of events began when he received a letter from Chicago informing him that its sender, one Barbara Lathrop, would soon be arriving in Java with a small party consisting of his brother, his sister-in-law, and a woman about Fairchild's age by the name of Carrie McCormick. A trip from Chicago to Java may have taken a month, or longer, but since Lathrop had sent the letter only days before his party departed, the missive barely beat Lathrop to the island. Contained in his note was the unsubtle implication that Fairchild would be available to stand in as the group's tour guide. This was the second time Lathrop called upon Fairchild, both times almost unannounced. Lathrop traveled constantly, but to journey straight from America to Java, an interminable ocean voyage few would envy and even fewer would take, makes one wonder at his motives to see, of all people he had met in the world, this young man who had somehow captured his attention. Fairchild rushed to the port. When he approached the group, out of breath, Lathrop was in the middle of a story. He looked Fairchild up and down, his eyes lingering on his protege's white Dutch suit that buttoned up to the chin. Months in the sweaty tropics had left Fairchild thin, almost emaciated. Lathrop said he was shocked at Fairchild's appearance. Never had so much money, looked like so little. Lathrop was not especially close with his brother, Brian Lathrop, and he had agreed to the trip only after Brian had begged. Traveling with people annoyed Barber. Too many people brought too many opinions, which required compromise. Money was not the problem. The Lathrops were laden with means, owing to the lucrative banking career of their father, Jedediah Hyde Lathrop, who had made several wise investments, none wiser than a real estate play following the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. It was hardly a gamble. The fire created the biggest redevelopment opportunity in American history. Barber Lathrop was pleased with his lineage. He was the grandson of the respected Governor James Barber of Virginia. But he never got along with his father. Jedediah had pushed his son to attend law school at Harvard, which Barber did. But when he finished, Barber decided he couldn't become a lawyer because, as he saw it, a lawyer cannot tell the truth. His incensed father responded that young Barber would not get another cent. In Barber Lathrop's retelling of the story, he replied to the ultimatum with a shrug. Poor in his early 20s, Lathrop committed his sharp wit and passion to the bombastic, first to New York, which didn't hold him, and then to California, an upstart state awash in ambition. In the 1870s, the West was still a new frontier, with a spirit unencumbered by the divisions over slavery that still hung in the East. Gold had attracted opportunists to California in the 1840s and 50s. By the 70s, the game was either mining silver or trying to predict its fluctuating price. In San Francisco, the rumor of someone discovering a new vein would cause a mining stock to rocket 1,000%, creating fortunes overnight. The entire city buzzed with tales of chambermaids who bought the rooming houses they had worked in a few weeks earlier, and of former ditch diggers riding down newly fashionable Kearney Street in opulent carriages, one historian wrote of the era. Lathrop didn't care about wealth as much as he wanted to be somebody, so he took his first job as a reporter, or as he pretentiously put it, a newspaperman, for the San Francisco Morning Call, where he'd have a front row seat to important events. He dressed aspirationally, wearing fine suits and hats. He even bought a revolver from a gun salesman who fed Lathrop's ego by claiming, correctly, that a man of Lathrop's status would need to use it one day. It turned out that his father's ultimatum had been good only in life, not in death. When Jedediah died in 1889, he made each of his three progeny instant millionaires.
The money immediately changed Barbara Lathrop. He quit his job at the morning call and began smoking fatter cigarettes. He passed his days in the gentleman-only Bohemian Club, a tall brick building near San Francisco's Union Square that attracted Lathrop's type, the wealthy, powerful, and artistically minded, who sought out the company of men, and men only. Amid boisterous conversation with writers, musicians, and patrons of the arts, Lathrop emitted baritone guffaws and plotted pranks, such as the time he convinced a man with thinning hair to emulate the people in Timbuktu, who he claimed stimulated their scalps with raw onions steeped in gin. Lathrop became known as the sire of hijinks. At 43, Lathrop was uninterested in the path of most men his age, namely, to invest in property, marry, and raise a large family. He rented a room on the top floor of the Bohemian Club. His only close friends were other men he met in the dining room and in the smoking parlor, or on the streets of San Francisco. Fraternal gossip seemed to delight him, but when boredom inevitably set in, the next itch to strike him was to travel. By the fourth day of Fairchild's stint as a tour guide on Java, the group was reaching its limit. Brian Lathrop, on his maiden voyage east, was unaccustomed to humidity, and he squabbled with his brother about the indignities of foreign travel, setting Barbara's nerves on edge. Meanwhile, Brian's wife annoyed everyone with incessant questions, fired in scattershot fashion. Fairchild was unperturbed. He took the young woman, Carrie McCormick, on a boat ride near an island full of bats. Had he known she came from the venerable McCormick family, the great Chicago dynasty of Robert McCormick, who invented the mechanized reaper, one of the greatest tools in agricultural history, he might have thought twice about asking the man rowing the boat to clap the oars together with such a loud thwack that bats blackened the sky above them. A sight that delighted Fairchild left the young woman rattled for days. Lathrop, meanwhile, was anxious and lonely, and had exhausted his patience. It didn't help that Fairchild's command of the Malay language was poor, or that Lathrop banished him from the hotel one afternoon after Fairchild ate a noxious-smelling durian. "Fairchild, I don't like this traveling with a party," Lathrop said one night in Bandung. "I'm not accustomed to it. They don't like the same things that I do, and what's the use?" It was time, he felt, to abandon the others and move on. He asked Fairchild to join him. "There is nothing in those termites. Leave them alone and come along with me, and I will show you the world." Fairchild replied sheepishly that he couldn't leave Java, that his research had just begun, that he had only been on the island for 8 months. But Lathrop answered the excuses with his classic dismissal. "You're working too hard, and you need a change," Lathrop said. Fairchild felt guilty at the prospect of leaving the job Dr. Troob had created for him. But Lathrop promised to cover every expense and to pay him the salary he would be forfeiting. Lathrop also enchanted him with a promise that, as soon as a boat could be arranged, they would head together up the west side of Sumatra, an island rich in minerals, fruits, and tribes seen by few people with white skin. Unable to say no, and convinced that Lathrop would reject his refusal anyway, Fairchild accepted. Lathrop arranged a steamer for his brother, sister-in-law, and Carrie McCormick to return to the United States. As soon as they departed, he made arrangements for himself and Fairchild. Their boat left Batavia and traveled west, through the Sunda Strait, where the passengers gathered on deck for a sight of the famous Krakatoa volcano, which had erupted a decade earlier in an explosion so extraordinary that 3 months afterward, officials in New York and Connecticut deployed fire engines when smoke in the distance erroneously indicated a massive blaze. The boat turned north to Padang, the port on Sumatra's west coast. As the vessel approached land, Fairchild stood on the bow to watch the endless forests draw closer. The island appeared raw and green, a chain of protruding volcanoes stretching across the horizon like the backbone of a sleeping dinosaur. As he awaited his ship's landing, Fairchild penned a letter to his mother in Kansas. A typical young man in the 19th century might live in his parents' home until he married.
Yet Charlotte Fairchild's son had left not only his home, but his country, writing from as far from Kansas as one could possibly be. He told his mother of Barbara Lathrop, of his abundance of personality and money, and recounted his hasty departure from Java and the impending arrival in Sumatra. He assured her that, in all his time living abroad, he had yet to experience even one serious accident. Fate can always be tempted. As he was sealing the letter, he heard a shriek. A Malay man on board was tussling with a waiter in the passageway. One wielded a hatchet, the other a dirk, each flailing his appendages. They wrestled down the passageway, attempting to stab each other, and then fell, their bodies interlocked, into Lathrop's cabin and doused his trunk with blood. Lathrop yelled and shooed. He and the ship's captain tried to separate the pair. It took another minute to put them in restraints, and for some soldiers to drag them away on their heels, their bodies dripping a crimson trail. The glue on the envelope was still wet. Fairchild peeled it open and amended his letter with a postscript. Chapter 4. Guest and Protégé. One of the biggest uncertainties for an American traveling in the East was what kind of people he'd meet, and whether they'd be friendly. The Malay tribes on Sumatra, in their colorful garments, looked more welcoming than the serious people of Java. The most striking feature were women's earrings, which looked less like ornaments than ear buttons. After getting their ears pricked, toddlers wore rolled banana leaves to enlarge the holes. When the child reached fertility, the openings would be an inch in diameter. Only after she delivered her first child would she take them out, leaving her elongated lobes to flap against her cheeks. Fairchild didn't know how long he and Lathrop would stay in Padang, so he wandered around to survey the area and maybe collect a few things. A yellow raspberry caught his eye, and he pulled it to taste, tart and mealy. A moment later, he came across the tallest, thickest cane of bamboo he had ever seen, its shaft 30 feet tall and deep green. Bamboo isn't a tree, but an overgrown grass, and Fairchild shook it to test its strength. The hefty joints separated, and the stalk cracked in half and tumbled down around him, the weight of 2x4s barely missing his head. Fairchild would one day describe bamboo as the most beautiful and useful of plants, but for the moment, he decided to leave it where it was. As travel companions, the botanist and the playboy were a study in contrasts. Lathrop was always immaculately dressed and groomed, his collar left open, his mustache plumped. Fairchild, by comparison, wore baggy pants that didn't fit, and his necktie was never tied correctly. He couldn't dance or make small talk. At times, the two men rarely spoke. The two-man odyssey was plagued by growing pains and, true to form, Lathrop quickly grew impatient with his companion. The tall, rich man was unable to slow down, and Fairchild, earnest and awkward, seemed incapable of moving faster. "Lathrop was a rapid traveler, and I was a rather slow and deliberate collector," Fairchild later remembered. "He didn't propose to spend the rest of his life on that fever-infested coast, and I didn't see what was the use of just a glimpse of plants that there was no time to collect." If they had been closer to America, Lathrop at this point probably would have sent Fairchild home, conceding that the whole idea of traveling together had been foolish. Lathrop believed an expedition could only have one leader, him. He made all the major decisions about where they'd go and where they'd stay. He sighed loudly in frustration. But once Fairchild had experienced the full range of Lathrop's moods, he realized that the older man's lectures were meant more to be therapeutic than instructional, and the harsh words lost their bite. Fairchild learned to listen without listening, if only in anticipation of the several quiet hours that would follow each outburst. Lathrop came from Alexandria, Virginia, the kind of town that valued cultural refinement and a proper way of doing things, and where anything in violation could be decried as endangering the public morality. The windswept plains of Kansas, where Fairchild grew up, had little to offer as high-minded culture or art. Other than the rotation of visiting professors who stopped by the Fairchild family's house, Fairchild's parents were hardly socialites. His sheltered upbringing may go some way toward explaining his gullibility and discomfort traveling with Lathrop and in a group. When Lathrop told a story, Fairchild would stand nearby and laugh when others did. The rest of the time, he stayed quiet. A man on board with a camera asked to take their photo. Lathrop stared at the lens while Fairchild looked to the side, feeling as small and timid as he looked. Most of the time, he simply didn't know what to say. One morning, after an entire breakfast filled with one-sided conversation, Lathrop stood up and threw his napkin down. "My God, man, can't you talk?" he yelled and stormed out. And yet, Fairchild looked at Lathrop with reverence so deep he might have drowned in it. "I was the guest and protege of the greatest world traveler and one of the greatest interviewers America had produced," he would write of his deep fascination. Fairchild's fawning obedience explains his eagerness to push on. But why would Lathrop, a man of such confidence and wealth, be drawn to compromise? Men who write little down cannot be easily analyzed, but Lathrop had developed a fondness for well-formed young men, those established in upbringing but still impressionable in character. Fairchild wasn't the first sidekick Lathrop had taken on. Two others had come prior, but had left before long, one from impatience, and the other who annoyed Lathrop to the point of dismissal. There's no evidence that Lathrop ever discussed his sexuality, but signs point to his discomfort in established society, not least his apathy toward marriage in an era when it was the norm, and his eagerness to remain in feverish motion, as if evading something he couldn't outrun. Lathrop identified himself as bohemian to describe both his lifestyle quirks and his unwillingness to conform. It also explained where he lived. The Bohemian Club, the only place where Lathrop ever had a permanent address, was full of other men who styled themselves bohemian, a masking word for something that didn't quite have a name. The fashion of the so-called gay 90s in places like New York and San Francisco wasn't necessarily to be with other men, but simply to revel in the strangeness of it. Only a little before the 1890s was there a clinical term, homosexuality, to describe someone's sexual identity. And only in the 1890s did men begin to tiptoe more boldly toward the company of other men for reasons of inexplicable attraction in established smoking clubs on America's coasts. If Lathrop was, in fact, drawn to men, he would have had good reason to be cagey. There was a stigma attached to being sexually different and a deep risk of ostracism. Bans on gay bars and social clubs effectively regulated gender, outlining permissible speech patterns, attire, and demeanor in polite society. Policing gender came in the form of vigilante enforcement on the streets, where men thought to be queer were roughed up and jeered. Social punishment was worse, the loss of jobs, family, and social respect. Efforts to avoid this fate and still make oneself known to like-minded men caused distress, and from that anxiety came creative ways to both blend in and stand out. Gay men secretly announced themselves to each other with red ties and bleached hair. The best way to navigate was with multiple alibis, pushing most gay men to lead mirrored lives. Lathrop lived in and seemed to pass with relative ease through a world where everything had double meanings, where people were mysterious because they had to be. One way to explain his constant travel may be that, in the distant places he visited, no one knew him well enough to judge. "It's a collection expedition," Lathrop said matter-of-factly one morning, looking away from his newspaper. "We'll be collecting things." Fairchild had built up the courage to ask Lathrop what exactly they were doing. He had been lured by the promise of luxury travel to untouched lands, but when he sat to write letters, he struggled to explain why he had left Java. He hardly knew where they were headed next. After the novelty of travel began to fray, the wheels might have fallen off Fairchild and Lathrop's Odyssey, if the Odyssey had wheels to begin with. With more bluster than actual purpose, they were, in a real sense, floating. Lathrop's haughty aloofness masked the reality that he was flying blind. Lathrop had seen more corners of the world than almost anyone alive, but his years of solo travel had lacked an objective, or even a general direction. At each port, he stumbled across things that, for a traveler, were simply there to observe, and then leave behind. Why not bring some of those oddities back? Was as much of a plan as Lathrop had considered. Something small here and there, altogether a few armloads to drop on the doorstep of the American people. What or for whom didn't matter so much as that Lathrop was repurposing personal enjoyment into a form of philanthropy. He must have realized that to do it effectively meant doing it scientifically, and conducting science required a scientist. Lathrop had only the training of a non-practicing lawyer and a short stint as a reporter. To bring his plan to life, he didn't want a botanist so much as need one. The relationship between the two thinned further in Padang, the port city of Sumatra that was the terminus for the new West Sumatra Railway. In silence, Fairchild and Lathrop took the train, the world's first to work on a system of cogs with teeth carrying a locomotive up a steep mountain. Swampy jungle lined both sides of the track, punctuated with atop palms that rose from the jungle floor as small shrubs with large plumes of leaves. Jungle gave way to periodic waterfalls with beds of rising steam. The mud below them was tropical soup, home to snakes, leeches, and uncountable insects. For hours, Fairchild, reluctant to talk and with little to say, stared out the windows, captivated by the foliage. Each plant had its own reason to be gawked at for a boy from the Midwest. If America's landscape was a black-and-white sketch on paper, Sumatra's was a nuanced portrait of watercolors. At the hotel the next morning, Lathrop stood waiting beside his fully packed trunk. Without a word, Fairchild understood that he was ready to leave. Such an island offered thousands, even millions of plants to collect. Fairchild could have spent a month there, three if he had his choice, but he also knew that Lathrop, when his mind was made up, couldn't be swayed. Fairchild's trunk joined Lathrop's on a horse carriage, which delivered them back to the train. Without one specimen collected, the two men returned down the mountain to Padang, where a steamer was waiting to continue up the coast. As the steamer cut north, Fairchild and Lathrop kept to their separate quarters. One night, when Lathrop and a group of Dutch officials were joking and gossiping in the smoking room, Lathrop slipped out to find Fairchild, who, with a lone candle, was hunched over a report. From the doorway, Lathrop delivered the closest thing yet to a compliment. "You're a worker, Fairchild," he said. "Whatever else, you aren't." When they arrived a day later at Fort de Kock, an area rich in waterfalls and sweeping gray cliffs, Fairchild left to collect. The ground was hard and the air dry, the perfect conditions for termites. Yet this was a poor decision. When Lathrop discovered Fairchild hunched on all fours digging in the dirt, he let loose. One can assume that in Lathrop's entire life, he had never had the occasion to position himself thus, in soil so dirty it had passed through the intestines of worms. Nor could a man of his stature understand why anyone would opt for behavior so undignified. Fairchild stood up, circles of mud at his knees. For the first time, he spoke back. If he was to collect things, Fairchild said, he needed time to understand what he was collecting. Collecting useful things couldn't be done by grabbing indiscriminate handfuls of plants. Lathrop let silence hang for a moment. "If you're going to travel with me, I'll show you the world, but you can't stop every minute and collect specimens, or you won't get any general idea of the countries we travel through." Then he walked away. Fairchild felt embarrassed by the exchange, but he was also emboldened by it. If he was going to be the scientific muscle behind the expedition, he might begin acting like it, starting with speaking to Lathrop as a peer. The argument in the dirt gave Fairchild the confidence to seek out Lathrop that night as he read in his hotel room, novel in one hand, cherrywood cigarette holder in the other. Why, Fairchild wanted to know, had he left his unfinished studies in Germany and his incomplete work in Java? Why had he agreed to travel to strange places and meet new people? Tourism was good enough for Lathrop, but not for Fairchild, who felt listless
anxious, and unfocused. "Well," Lathrop began, a little impressed that Fairchild had grown a backbone,